The headlines: the U.S. president calls his Russian counterpart a war criminal and approves an additional $800 million in military aid to Ukraine. The Kremlin calls Russia unforgivable. Hackers publish personal files of the Israeli spy chief on social media, saying they will leak more information soon. And also in our headlines, Tehran says the release of two British Iranian nationals had nothing to do with the UK paying its overdue debt to Iran, as the two countries had already agreed on the issue. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: on day 22 of the Russian offensive in Ukraine, major cities are the scene of clashes, with Russian forces making a slow advancement. Heavy fighting is underway near the city of Kiev. At least one person was killed and several wounded after a missile hit a residential building in the capital. Several Ukrainian cities, including Sumy and Mariupol, are still under siege. According to Ukrainian authorities, 53 people were killed in the city of Chernihiv on Wednesday alone. Russia says it targeted a military depot in the western Rivne region with high-precision missiles. Russia began its military operation in Ukraine on February the 24th. The two sides have held several rounds of talks on a ceasefire without reporting a major breakthrough. U.S. President Joe Biden approves an additional $800 million in military aid to Ukraine as the conflict between Kiev and Moscow drags on.
On Saturday, my administration authorized another $200 million to keep a steady flow of weapons and ammunition moving to Ukraine. Now I'm once again using my presidential authority to activate an additional security assistance to continue to help Ukraine fend off Russia's assault. An additional $800 million in assistance. That brings the total of new U.S. security assistance to Ukraine to $1 billion just this week.
Biden says the U.S. will send more anti-aircraft, anti-armor weapons, and drones to Ukraine. He says Russia will have to pay a very heavy price for its offensive against Ukraine. The U.S. president also called his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, quote, a war criminal. Moscow has slammed the U.S. president's remarks on Putin as, quote, unacceptable and unforgivable rhetoric. Meanwhile, the NATO Secretary General said the alliance will continue to support Ukraine. Jens Stoltenberg, however, said the military bloc has no plans of deploying troops on the ground in Ukraine.
An emergency meeting of NATO defense ministers concluded at the military alliance's headquarters in Brussels on Wednesday. They are ready to defend NATO countries in the event Russia expands its mission beyond Ukraine, it's claimed.
There are now hundreds of thousands of forces at heightened alert across the alliance. 100,000 US troops in Europe.
A number of analysts have asked the question, how would Washington feel if Russia positioned 100,000 of its troops, for example, in Mexico? NATO military commanders have been ordered to examine how there can be even further expansion with respect to land, sea, air, cyber, and space capabilities. Jens Stoltenberg has called on NATO members to spend at least 2% of their GDP to grow military forces in response to Russia. Western powers say they won't get directly involved in the Ukraine conflict, but will continue to spend billions on arming Ukraine.
Certainly, we support their ability to defend themselves, and we'll continue to support them going forward.
Unprecedented sanctions against Moscow are starting to hit the EU's economy hard as fuel prices continue to rise and the cost of living generally goes up.
Those are substantial costs that will have to be paid by the EU collectively, but of course they will hit certain countries harder.
Sanctions are not the answer when it comes to dealing with Russia, according to some experts.
It's not a good situation because it seems to me there are a few mistakes. First of all, such kind of sanctions will be counterproductive generally. It's a way to confrontation.
As the war rages on, Joe Biden and other NATO leaders are due to hold a summit in the Belgian capital on Thursday of next week to consider further options. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Political commentator John Bosnich believes the U.S. and its allies are adding fuel to the fire by sending weapons and military equipment to Ukraine.
Well, there's been unfair demonization of Russia long before Vladimir Putin even came into public office. That is the basic background music coming from Washington since World War II. In this particular case, I regret to hear that the United States is encouraging the Ukrainian side by providing them these 800 million, and I'm sure much more covert support. There are probably, I've got friends in the U.S. military who are telling me that they have people in there on a covert basis. Unfortunately, this means that the United States will be pouring fuel on the fire and continuing to see a fight between two Slavic brother nations, the Slavic Russians and the Slavic Ukrainians. This is a tragedy for all Slavic nations.
Russia accuses Ukraine of developing biological weapons with the support of the United States, asking both countries to come clean about this illegal activity.
With regard to revealed facts of military biological activities in biolaboratories in Ukraine, these activities were carried out with the support of the United States in violation of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention. We demand that Kiev and Washington provide all the information about military and biological activities in the laboratories of Ukraine and take necessary steps to address this issue.
Elsewhere in her remarks, the spokeswoman noted the Adar battalion, which is part of the Ukrainian military, has been committing heinous crimes on a large scale against civilians in the Donbas region. He said the forces use men, women, and children as human shields and do not allow them to use humanitarian corridors to flee war zones. She also underlined that Kiev is funded by the Council of Europe to advance its own material interests, adding the Ukrainian government only cares about profits and not human lives. Meantime, in an emotional video conference with the German parliament, Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky demanded the tearing down of what he called a wall against freedom erected by Russia in Europe. Referring to the fall of the Berlin Wall, Zelensky accused Moscow of creating a wall between peace and strife. He called the oral pledges worthless, saying some of the sanctions on Russia and assistance to Ukraine came too late to stop the offensive. Zelensky also said that Ukraine will join the European Union, but did not elaborate. He delivered the speech just a day after addressing the U.S. Congress, where he urged Washington for more military assistance. The instability in Ukraine continues to wreak havoc on oil prices across Europe. In France, protests against record petrol prices have begun, but the government refuses to cut extremely high taxes on gasoline. Rami Mazzardi has more from Paris.
A coalition of truckers, farmers, fishermen, and public contractors are blocking refineries as oil prices in France have hit an all-time high, surpassing 2 euros per liter. Added to higher costs at the pump is inflation in prices of food and general goods, as well as looming shortages of vital industrial commodities. France could be headed for a spring of economic discontent amid a presidential election.
Début 2021, le prix du brut était à 51 dollars le baril.
At the start of 2021, the price of gas was at $50 a barrel. First, we had the demand shock caused by the end of coronavirus lockdowns. And then we had a supply shock caused by the failure to meet that demand shock. And now we have the unrest in Ukraine, shocking not just the oil market, but seemingly every market. It's been quite a roller coaster.
Last week, the European Union decided against sanctioning Russian fossil fuels, which would have provoked catastrophic economic consequences. However, France has just announced plans to end Russian gas and oil imports in just 5 years. They also announced a package of measures designed to protect French businesses and consumers from rampant inflation, but there's not much they can do about the actual price of oil. The government recently announced a rebate of 15 cents per liter on all gasoline from April 1st until August 1st, but they didn't do one thing in their power, reduce gasoline taxes.
In France, two-thirds of the price of gas comes from taxes. Gas taxes are regressive and not progressive because they hurt the lower classes more than the rich. In 2018, the Yellow Vest movement was sparked by an increase in gas taxes.
Gas prices back then were just €1.50 per liter, illustrating how precarious the situation is for the average Frenchman and perhaps for politicians facing re-election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A Telegram channel leaks personal information and photos linked to the chief of Israel's intelligence service. Mossad, a video with translations in Arabic, Hebrew, and English, shows a series of family photos and documents that is said to belong to David Barnea. The channel claims the documents are the result of years of surveillance campaigns against the Mossad chief, but Israel says the materials in question are old and do not come from Barnea's personal phone. The leaked files have been published on a Telegram channel called Open Hands, which has started its activity just a few days ago. The leakers say they'd release more materials about the Mossad chief and other Israeli intelligence officials in the near future. Iran will export domestically produced coronavirus vaccines to Nicaragua. The country's Barakat Foundation has just signed a deal with the Nicaraguan government. It's the first export deal made by an Iranian vaccine maker. Health officials say five other countries have placed orders for the jabs. The vaccine, branded as Coviron Barakat, was unveiled over 2 years ago and was licensed for use in June. The foundation says it has produced over 60 million doses so far. In late November, Iran's health ministry authorized vaccine makers to export 20% of their output. After most of the population was inoculated under a mass vaccination scheme, 67% of the population is fully vaccinated, and about 30% have received a third booster shot. We've spoken to the chief executive officer of the Barakat Pharmaceutical Group, Akbar Burandegi. He says the company is working to obtain approval from the World Health Organization to export their vaccine to more countries.
When it comes to vaccination, even if one person in the world should not contract the disease, or it will spread again. So after our vaccine are globally registered, we will move towards exporting vaccines to other countries so that they can use our vaccines as well. So the countries which need vaccines, we can help them, we can meet their demands. This stage has been set. Also, as I told you, the Coviran Barakat vaccine produced by Iran, in some countries, we are making preparations, and it is possible now to export vaccines to those countries. In the not too distant future, our vaccine, upon the registration of our vaccine by the WHO, the stage will be set for the export of this vaccine to other countries. Now, five countries have applied for this vaccine, and talks have got underway in that regard. I hope that we will be able to export the vaccine to different countries and to some countries around the world.
Two British Iranian nationals who served a whole and part of their jail sentences for espionage in Iran have arrived in the UK after being released. Nazanin Zaghari Radcliffe was arrested in 2016 and subsequently sentenced to 5 years in prison for involvement in espionage. Later, she was sentenced to one more year for anti-Iran propaganda. Anusha Ashuri, another British Iranian, was also given conditional release because of his age and health. He was sentenced to 10 years in jail on the charges of spying for Israel and acquiring illegal wealth. Ashuri served nearly half of his sentence. Meanwhile, London has settled a long overdue debt of $530 million to Tehran. Britain owed the amount it received from the former Pahlavi regime for military vehicles, which were never delivered. Britain had been using different pretexts for the delay, including anti-Iran sanctions. Iran says there's no relationship between London paying its overdue debt to Tehran and the release of two British-Iranian nationals. The comments were made by Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh. He said Iran and the UK signed an agreement last summer for the payment of London's debt, but the British government failed to live up to it. Khatibzadeh said Iran released the two prisoners on the basis of Islamic leniency and humanitarian considerations. The official stressed that Iran has never backed down on its position on reclaiming the rights of its people. Khatibzadeh said after a delay of over 40 years, the British government recently paid its debt following lengthy talks with Iran. He noted that London used political issues as a pretext to avoid repaying its debt during all these years. The Mayor of London and a group of British parliamentarians have joined the chorus of outrage that is building after details of the inhumane fashion in which a black teenage girl was strip-searched at school after wrongly being accused of possessing cannabis. The report into the incident, which occurred in East London in 2020, is again shining a spotlight on the disproportionate way ethnic minorities are overpoliced in the UK. Eamonn Taylor has more.
Safeguarding Review has issued a damning report into the treatment of a young black girl who was strip-searched by police at school. The traumatic search by Metropolitan Police officers took place at the girl's school without adult supervision and in the knowledge she was menstruating, the report adds. The report concludes that the strip search should never have happened, was unjustified, and racism was likely to have been an influencing factor. Though the report is damning, how did this ever happen? As part of her written submission to the review, the pupil, referred to as Child Q, said,
"All the people that allowed this to happen need to be held responsible. I was held responsible for a smell, but I'm just a child."
The Metropolitan Police have responded to the results of the safeguarding review, calling the incident regrettable. They've also apologised to the young lady in question, apologised to her family and to the wider community. But the question is just how many times will the Met find itself having to defend its actions? Though shocking, the case highlights the fact that ethnic minority minors are disproportionately impacted by their interactions with law enforcement and other officials.
Because they're being racially profiled by the Metropolitan Police Service, and that racial profiling, which has criminalised large sections of the black community through stop and search, is being colluded with and maintained by individual schools who, rather than sticking to their safeguarding policies and placing the first interest of the child at the centre of everything they do, are more than willing to acquiesce to an instruction from a police officer to find a room so we can strip search a child.
Family members have described Child Q as changing from a happy-go-lucky girl to a timid recluse that hardly speaks, who now self-harms and needs therapy. The Met Police said the Independent Office for Police Conduct was investigating the incident. Eamonn Taylor, London.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. Well, I will raise a few points about Ba'atha briefly, and then I will make a point about the current issues of the day. One thing about Ba'atha is that it achieved something that seemed impossible. What was it? It was that Ba'atha turned the people of the Arabian Peninsula of the pre-Islamic period, later on I'll explain how they were like before Ba'atha, into a virtuous people like the Islamic Ummah. Like the Islamic Ummah of the Holy Prophet's rule, such a thing seems impossible with the ordinary and conventional viewpoint. The people of Arabia in the period of ignorance before the Holy Prophet's Ba'atha had characterized some of which are mentioned in Nahjul Balagha and in history. They were misguided people, wandering aimless and extremely ignorant. They were suffering from great seditions caused by the extreme rage and ignorance. At the same time, as well as all these attributes that I enumerated, they were suffering from illiteracy and lack of understanding. They were devoid of any morality, and they did not have any goal and purpose. Nonetheless, they were extremely ignorant and extremely violent, unreasonable and stubborn. These were the characteristics of the people of Arabia, the people of Mecca and the rest of the places that were there at that time. And these qualities were shared by their elders and younger ones and their chiefs and subordinates.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Holy Prophet, ﷺ, however, turned the same people into a united people, and he did so in a short period of time. If we look at the Muslims of the Holy Prophet's time, whether when they were confined to Medina or when they advanced to Mecca, Taif, and other places, we see that they were united, virtuous, and altruistic, and they enjoyed all their lofty temperaments. He turned the same people into such individuals that seemed impossible. No analysis would have found it possible to turn those people into such individuals in a short space of time. And later on, in less than 20 years, they received global recognition. The same people with those characteristics achieved worldwide fame in less than 20 years once they accepted Islam.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. You've done for me through all my years. I've
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Sunday, Saudi Arabia executed 81 men over terrorism-related charges. It's the largest mass execution the country has so far carried out on record. The figure exceeded the country's total death sentences it handed down last year. Of the 81 people, 73 were Saudi citizens, 7 were Yemeni, and 1 was a Syrian national. More than half of those executed were Shia Muslims, including teenagers from the Recife Qatif region. The convicts also included members of Yemen's Ansarullah movement. They were accused of having links to Daesh and Al-Qaeda terror groups, but documents verifying the charges are yet to be made public.
Look, in the past, it's been quite clear over a number of years that the kingdom is in no way averse to executing people without what under Sharia would count as due process, and in particular targeting individuals because of the beliefs they hold.
The announcement drew widespread condemnation from around the world. Rights activists say the prisoners were put to death for nonviolent acts. Advocates are also questioning the validity of the court proceedings and treatment of the inmates. They say some of the trials were held in secret and that the prisoners had been tortured. Saudi Arabia's last mass execution came on January 2, 2016, when the kingdom killed 47 prisoners, including prominent Shia cleric Sheikh Nimr Bahr al-Nimr. They, too, were given capital punishment without fair trials. The cleric's only crime was to call for democracy and rally anti-regime protests. The mass execution drew fierce criticism from the international community. Iran has called it an inhumane act that violated basic human rights principles and international law. The Iranian president has slammed Western countries' double standards as well as the silence and inaction of the self-proclaimed human rights advocates regarding the execution of innocent people. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has also slammed the Saudi execution of inmates as a heinous crime. It accused Riyadh of practicing the ugliest forms of sectarian discrimination. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet condemned the violent act. She said war crimes may have been committed if people were beheaded following court cases that do not offer proper fair trial guarantees. Some experts believe the move to be a muscle flex by Saudi Arabia amid the Russia-Ukraine conflict that is leading to a global energy crisis and has sent the West scrambling to fight alternative sources of oil. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's planned visit to the kingdom can indicate that the West will be forgiving of the country's crimes. As a matter of fact, human rights campaigners are accusing Johnson of trying to trade oil for blood. The same criticisms were leveled against the kingdom after the killing of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the country's consulate in the Turkish city of Istanbul. But no punishment came Saudi Arabia's way.
Well, clearly the kingdom is considered by the United States to be a very special ally. And in that regard, the priorities the Americans have in dealing with the kingdom relate to basically the massive oil reserves, which are still at Saudi Arabia's disposal. But there can be no doubt that the West and the news media generally, even though there's been some coverage of this story, is dealing with it in a very hypocritical manner.
Reports of mistreatment of prisoners in Saudi jails also abound. Without seeing proper consequences, the kingdom isn't likely to change course in the foreseeable future.
In the early hours of Sunday, massive explosions rocked the capital of Iraq's northern Kurdistan region, Erbil. A dozen ballistic missiles hit secret Mossad bases there, reportedly leaving several Israeli operatives dead. Then a statement came from Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. The force said it had fired powerful and precision strike missiles targeting a strategic center for conspiracy and evil acts of the Zionists. The IRGC said the attack follows Israel's recent crimes and promised that those atrocities would not go unanswered. The IRGC warned that further Israeli acts of aggression would receive a tough, decisive, and destructive response. It underlined that the security of Iranian nationals was the red line of the country's armed forces. Israel has long been blamed for a wide range of anti-Iran measures, including acts of sabotage against its nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iranian scientists. Former Israeli officials have also confirmed the regime's role in the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq in 2020. And just last week, two IRGC officers were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Syrian capital, Damascus. At the time, the IRGC vowed that Israel would pay for the crime. In 2018, Israel killed a number of Iranians during an attack on an airbase near the city of Homs in western Syria. There have been a number of Iranian military advisors in Syria, as requested by the Damascus government. Iran later retaliated with a barrage of missiles targeting Israeli military positions in the occupied Golan Heights. The missile strike on Erbil could be seen in the same light. Iraq's Kurdistan regional government officials have denied the presence of Israeli bases in Erbil, but the two sides enjoy friendly ties. Back in 2014, Israel bought Kurdish oil despite opposition from the central Iraqi government and threats to take legal action. 3 years later, Israel endorsed an independence referendum carried out in the Kurdistan region. And last year, Erbil hosted a conference on normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel, prompting public outcry. The Kurdish regional government said it was not aware of the conference being organized. The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for the Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country. The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country.
Iran's retaliatory strike against an informal Israeli base in Iraq, which was in response to an act of Israeli aggression in Syria, which resulted in the deaths of two members of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, serves as another stark reminder to Israel's ruling elite, namely that Iran has the intent and the capability to effectively respond to acts of Israeli aggression, either against Iran directly, or against Iranian interests in the Middle East, or against Iran's allies in the Middle East, such as Syria. And I am of the opinion that the Iranian retaliatory strike against the unofficial Israeli base in Iraq will not be lost on the Israeli ruling elite.
Syria and the Israeli regime are technically at war due to the latter's 1967 occupation of the Arab country's Golan Heights. The Israeli regime maintains a significant military presence in the territory, which it uses as a launchpad for its attacks on the Syrian soil. Israel has attacked Syria repeatedly through the past years. The reasons it provides fall short of being enough to justify the death and destruction that it has caused. Tel Aviv has been a key supporter of terrorist groups fighting to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad since March 2011. The regime has also been providing safe passage and medical treatment to the Takfiri terrorists who flee the Allies' defensive operations. Israel's recent attack on the Syrian capital led to the martyrdom of two Iranian military advisors with the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The elite military force has been providing Syria with military advisory assistance in the face of foreign-sponsored militancy.
Iran has developed a very strong and a very robust armed forces which can meet Israeli aggression. Nonetheless, the Israelis, because of the unconditional support they receive year on year from Washington, will continue to act in the most criminal way possible.
Israel violates international law as well as international humanitarian law and refuses to implement dozens of resolutions or abide by recommendations put forward by relevant United Nations committees. Isn't it time the UN or other world countries gave this the attention that it deserves before the situation spirals out of control? The UN Security Council meeting turned into a heated argument between Moscow and Washington. The US and Russian delegates exchanged accusations over alleged biological weapons in Ukraine. The Russian envoy warned the European countries of the danger posed by Ukraine's research into biological weapons. Russia says the US-funded biolabs have researched spreading the highly infectious bird flu virus through migratory birds and pathogens such as bacteria and viruses that can be transmitted from bats to humans. The US, however, rejected Russia's allegation of biological activities, claiming that biological laboratories in Ukraine have nothing to do with chemical arms. It also interpreted the accusation as a sign that Moscow plans to use chemical or biological weapons in Ukraine. Washington initially condemned Russia for spreading disinformation. Nevertheless, after Russia published documents showing that Kyiv was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon, U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland admitted the existence of U.S.-funded biological research facilities in the country, saying Washington is working with Kyiv to prevent Russia from getting the research materials. The contradictive remarks further deepen the world's doubts about the US. Why is the US hastily attempting to destroy the materials? Is it trying to hide something?
Well, first of all, the United States specializes in moving its chemical and biological weapons activities away from its own territory to allow itself a degree of deniability. In other words, we didn't do that. It was a private venture of an academic institute or of a government department not related to the militaries.
The United States has spent more than $200 million on the work of biological laboratories in Ukraine. It has 30 biological laboratories and other related facilities in the country which are possibly involved in the production of bioweapons. And these are less than 10% of the 336 biological laboratories the US reportedly controls in 30 countries around the world. Deputy Chairman of the Council of Ministers of Crimea, Georgi Muradov, says the United States had plans to open a biolab on the peninsula before its annexation to Russia. He also accused the Pentagon of developing biological weapons in its secret laboratories under Ukrainian territory. Also, China has called on the United States to release all-around details of its biological laboratories in Ukraine and urged relevant parties to ensure their safety. The US has blocked the building of the Biological Weapons Convention Verification Protocol for 2 decades and refused to accept inspections of biological facilities within and outside its borders, despite having over 300 biological laboratories all over the world. It seems that by doing so, the US wants to protect the secrets of its biological labs worldwide. It's reasonable and legitimate for the international community to question the US for that, especially since it has a history of using chemical weapons. The US dropped massive quantities of white phosphorus on the Iraqi city of Fallujah during an attack on the city in November 2004, killing insurgents and civilians with the appalling burns that are the signature of this weapon. Also, 5 decades after the Vietnam War ended, Agent Orange continues to impact communities in Vietnam and Laos today. It contains dioxin, one of the most toxic chemicals known to humans. It is linked to increased rates of cancers and birth defects. Vietnam says several million people have been affected by Agent Orange, including 150,000 children born with severe birth defects.
Well, the United States has always managed to present two faces to the world. One is the face of the American democracy attempting to achieve peace according to their propaganda, and the other is the military-industrial complex that runs the American economy by making wars. So the political element of the U.S. system denies involvement in such activities, while behind the back of the public, even the American public, is deceived in order to keep the regime popular at home. But behind the back of the American public, the United States is more involved than any other country in the world in these areas.
Biological weapons are seen as weapons of mass destruction together with nuclear and chemical weapons. Any suspicion of biological weapons must be promptly investigated. Therefore, the US owes the world an answer on what it has been up to in its so-called biological research facilities in Ukraine.
September 11, 2001. The United States is hit by 4 coordinated terrorist attacks, the first major assault on the U.S. soil since World War II. Nearly 3,000 people are killed and some 20,000 others injured. The U.S. responds with an all-out war on Afghanistan, where the terror group Al-Qaeda that planned and carried out the attack was said to be based. Fast forward 20 years. U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order in September giving the Justice Department a 6-month notice to release the documents on the FBI's investigations into the incident. Yet on Thursday, the department acknowledged that it would miss the deadline, suggesting that they would be released by mid-April. It says the delay is due to continuing coordination with a number of foreign governments and ongoing interagency review. One of the governments in question is likely to be Saudi Arabia. Out of 19 terrorists involved in the attacks, 15 were Saudi nationals. The close ties between Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Saudi royal family also raised questions that Saudi Arabian authorities supported the operation. Some observers believe the conflict in Ukraine and the West's sweeping sanctions on Russia, especially its energy sector, which has sent fuel prices skyrocketing around the world, could explain the delay in the release of the documents, as the United States needs Saudi Arabia, with the world's second largest oil reserves, to fill in the gap.
And obviously there's a quid pro quo going on here. How serious it's going to be is another question. You've still got, hanging over all of this, the fact that Vice President Cheney at the time, in 9/11, arranged for all these Saudis to leave the country, leave the United States and go back to Saudi Arabia. So there was no follow-up at the time, contemporaneously, with the Saudi presence in the United States, or the fact that most of the people who were involved in the actual hijackings of these planes were Saudis. So clearly, there is something here that is extremely troubling. And clearly, the Saudis do not want this out. And I suspect there are large sections of the United States government who are not interested in having a serious discussion about this.
But the delay isn't good news to thousands of families who are seeking justice for the loved ones they lost on 9/11. Soon after taking office, Joe Biden said the U.S. was ending all its support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, proclaiming that the war has to end. But back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden, with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he staked much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States.
It's unlikely that people are going to support the United States in the hour of need without some concessions. I mean, I just don't see it. It's possible, I suppose. Maybe there's some threats or whatever, but it's unlikely. And the Saudis have been very clear in the paper today. They said they want more support by the United States for their adventure in Yemen, among other things. There was a list.
The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. But will it forgive possible perpetrators of attacks on its own citizens too? What message would that have for the attackers? Wouldn't that embolden them to commit even worse crimes, knowing that it can get away with murder in its most literal sense?
Congratulations to everyone on 15th of Sha'ban, the birthday anniversary of the Imam of the Age, Abu Saleh al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. We hereby at Arabi English Radio congratulate all Muslims on the occasion of 15th of Sha'ban, the birthday anniversary of the 12th Imam, Al-Qa'im al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance.
One of the good achievements of Sheikh Muhammad Taqi Qumi is this one, that he had a very nice communication with the Sunni heads of Sunni community in the Egypt.
In order to get these different cultures closer to each other, he decided to focus on the main pillars of Islam and forget about differences in branches.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
What will we say in front of it?
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
The program The Teacher is about the lives and the works of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, jurists, philosophers, and thinkers all across the nation of Islam. And for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding Shiite dignitaries, cleric, one of the scholars who dedicated his life on establishing dialogue and unity among the Muslim denomination and sects all across the nation of Islam. He is no one but Ayatollah Muhammad Taqi Qumi. Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you this episode. Give us some information about the early life of Muhammad Taqi Qumi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Muhammad Taqi Qumi was born in 1289 according to solar calendar. He was born in 1910.
Yes.
He was born in the city of Qom, and He moved to Tehran when he was very young and studied in elementary school and then in high school in Tehran, and he studied in literature. Besides studying in high school and, you know, learning the Arabic language, French language, and English, he studied in Islamic Studies Seminary. And from that moment on, you know, I think that because he learned three languages beside his mother tongue language, that was Farsi or Persian, this mindset was formed in his mind that taqrib is very important for Muslim Ummah. That's why when he was 27, he moved to Egypt to actualize this idea that letting Muslims sit beside each other and to have them tolerate each other.
That's right.
And be a friend of each other. So Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Qommi moved to Egypt. And you know, the moment that this idea came to his mind and, you know, was strengthened in his mind was the event that took place in Mecca, that was a Shia follower of Islam.
That's right.
Was killed and was executed by a court in Saudi Arabia because he had vomited in Masjid al-Haram.
Okay.
So, because after this event, the political relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia was, you know, cut. And there were many, you know, tensions between Muslim Ummah.
That's right.
Or amongst Muslim Ummah. So that's why Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Qommi moved to Egypt to find a solution for this problem. And this shows that at the age of 27, he had great visions for Muslim Ummah. And this is very important. When you have great visions, you may take great steps.
That's all right.
And he was amongst those people who took great steps for the sake of Islam.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, is it true that it was over there that he was among the founders of Dar al-Taqrib Bain al-Mazahib al-Islamiyya and taking part in the sessions with the other leaders of Islamic denominations over there, isn't it?
Yeah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is, as it is recorded in the history, in cooperation with Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltoud and Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi. Actually, at that time, Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi, he was the head of the University Al-Azhar, and after him, Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltoud succeeded him in being the head of the University of Al-Azhar, and also in cooperation with Mustafa Abdul Razzal, who was the president of Egypt at that time. So this is also a very important point. This is also recorded in the history that, based on some narration, he was invited to Egypt by Sheikh Mustafa al-Maraghi, the head of the University of Al-Azhar, when he realized that this man and this scholar has the tendency of bridging the gaps between the sects. And since the Muslim Ummah at that time was suffering from the conflicts and segregations among themselves, so the head of Al-Azhar University, he was also of this view that this is a good idea to bring all Muslim leader around one table. Why? Because if we spread this ideology of unity among Muslim leader, then from the leaders it will go down to the followers.
That's right.
So one of the good achievements of Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Qommi is this one, that he had a very nice communication with the Sunni heads of Sunni community in the Egypt.
And was it his introduction out of the Shia and Jafari school of thought to our Sunni brother in Al-Azhar that made it official over there? I mean, because of his efforts and his presence. Because for sure, from a Sunni brethren, needed some clarifications and explanations, isn't it? And the best people in order to do so are the Muslim Shia scholars. Muhammad Taghi Qommi for sure was one of them, isn't it?
He was given the chair to teach in Al-Azhar University.
Oh.
And this is interesting that at the moment he was given this chance, and this is also narrated that he was not much confident upon talking about the issue of unity with
the vice chancellor of the Al-Azhar University, because, you know, if you are invited somewhere as a visiting professor, so you have to be conservative as much as you can. Why? Because you don't want to lose this opportunity. But for the sake of Islam, for the sake of unity, he talked, as it is narrated in his biography, that the moment I was talking to the head of Al-Azhar and I was bringing up the issue of unity among Muslim sects, I was really nervous. I was not sure if he is going to welcome this view, but interestingly, he welcomed this view, and we see the fruit of this communication is that the moment he was teaching in Al-Azhar, he benefited from that position to establish or to start publishing the journal Al-Islam.
Risalatul Islam.
Yes, Risalatul Islam.
That's right.
And when he comes back to Iran, he talks to Ayatollah Burujerdi, the head of Shia in the world of Islam.
Yes.
And he tells everything about his communication with the leaders of Sunnis in Egypt. And Ayatollah Burujerdi welcomes him with the open arms. And he himself, Ayatollah Burujerdi, he compiles, maybe the thing was ready at that moment, but he compiles an article on the Hadith Ghadir based on Sunni sources.
Yes.
And then this article will be published in where? In Risalatul Islam.
That's right.
The journal that Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Qumi founded in Al-Azhar.
That's right.
So from the position that he received in Al-Azhar.
Okay.
So he was trying really hard
right.
to establish this unity among Muslim sects in
That's
Islam.
That's right. Thank you very much. Sheikh Ziya, so when we get to the journal of Risalatul Islam, we could see that on different articles, he's explaining his methodology of establishing dialogue among different denominations and sects. Because you give us some of the practical thoughts of Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Qumi in order to reach such a goal. What are they?
First of all, we should know that he was believing that for establishment of united Ummah of Islam, there is no way but uniting the culture of Muslim communities and Muslim, you know,
cultural unity has to be established,
yes.
Okay?
And this cultural unity cannot be achieved unless you have dialogue and relationships. So in order to get these, you know, different cultures closer to each other, he decided to focus on the main pillars of Islam and forget about and overlooking about the differences in branches.
Yes.
So that's why he says that we need to have cultural unity in order to unite Muslim Ummah regarding the tenets of faith and to forget about the differences that led or direct us toward takfir and, you know, blaming each other.
Yes, very good.
So he believes that Muslim Ummah would not suffer from differences, but Muslim Ummah would suffer from cutting the relationships because of the differences.